Welcome to today's program titled The Intersection of Trade Secrets, Violations, and Criminal Law. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on all CLE attendance affirmation forms. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Michael Wexler. You may begin.
Good morning and good afternoon, depending on what part of the country you're in. Welcome to Saifar Shah's webinar with regard to the intersection of trade secrets, violations, and the criminal law. This morning, we have three speakers for you. There's Kate Pirelli, who is National Chair of the Legation Department for Saifar Shah. There is Andrew Boutros, co-chair of our white-collar practice and a former United States attorney, and myself, Mike Wexler. I chair the Trade Secrets Group nationally and as a former state prosecutor. Today, we have a lot of information to share with you. If you have questions, feel free to type them into the box on the left of your screen. We will try to get to some of those questions at the end. If we don't, we will certainly follow up with you in the days after this webinar, so that we can answer any questions you might have and interact with you in a positive way. So what are we going to hear about today? First, we're going to talk to you just very briefly about what a trade secret is. Some of you may know already, but we're going to give you just a little bit of basic information as to what that is. We will then talk to you about some of the key criminal statutes and the elements of those statutes so that you understand what the authorities are looking at when they're looking at a violation of federal law with regard to a trade secrets claim. We will then talk to you about some of the considerations that you may have. Do you report something to the FBI, the U.S. attorney, to local criminal authorities? Do you want to work with those folks with regard to a trade secrets claim? There's positives, there's negatives. You need to know what some of those considerations are, and we will talk through some of those with you. We'll also then talk to you a little bit about some cutting-edge stuff. You'll hear about how RICO, which typically is not a claim that's favored by judges when it comes to civil RICO claims being brought by private citizens, but the Defend Trade Secrets Act recently enacted in May of this year actually allows for the Defend Trade Secrets Act as a predicate act under the RICO statute, which means that RICO may be, once again, a remedy that folks want to pursue in civil litigation. And then finally, we'll talk about some best practices to deal with misappropriation. So for the basics, let's talk about some of the statutes. Some of the key statutes, you've probably heard of some of these. There's the Economic Espionage Act, a federal statute. There is now, under that statute, there's a theft of trade secrets portion, which is a federal statute, which means that the U.S. government, the U.S. Attorney's Office, can bring claims under that portion of the Economic Espionage Act. There's also the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is a statute that was typically used quite frequently with regard to someone who would go in and hack into or download information from, let's just say, a business. And that statute was routinely being used by civil litigants with regard to taking information. Again, there's some pluses and minuses with that statute and some very differing opinions on the case law, and Kate Pirelli will discuss those with you. And then finally, the hot new topic for 2016, the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016, which, of course, allows for a private right of action for U.S. citizens to bring claims of trade secret misappropriation at the federal level, no longer simply relying upon the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which is passed in 48 states in one form or another and used by civil litigants. So what's a trade secret? Basically, it is something that is secret that a business derives economic value from that information not being known to the public, not being known to competitors, and that you take protections that are reasonable under the circumstances to protect that information. That's the general definition. It's a little bit different than something that we simply call confidential information. Trade secrets, it's like confidential information, but even more secret, and importantly, you derive economic value from that information being secret. Here's some of the basic elements in sort of plain English for you. It's a secret. It's not generally known. You get a competitive advantage from it. It's information that cannot be reverse engineered by a competitor without them expending significant investment, time, effort, and expense. So something can be secret. Something could be out in the public. Maybe a competitor buys your product. They try to reverse engineer something with regard to it. It's not easily done because you have spent considerable time and money developing that product and protecting that product. The information is actually kept secret, and that means you use things like legends on documents that say, this is confidential, do not distribute outside the company. You have information that's password protected on computers. You have agreements with employees, all things that show you are keeping the information secret. And you must take, as it says here on the bottom point, affirmative measures to safeguard secrecy, which are some of the things we just mentioned. The Economic Espionage Act, a federal statute, 18 U.S.C. 1831. This is a statute that the federal government will come after you for under for trade secret misappropriation. There are some basic elements. You stole information from the person who owns it. You knew the information was proprietary. The information was, in fact, a trade secret, which means you have to prove that all the elements that we just mentioned in the earlier slide are met, and that you knew that that by taking this information, you knew by taking you would benefit some other person or foreign government or foreign agent. The civil cause of action under the Economic Espionage Act was created in 2012. That was for U.S. government and was limited to products and services in interstate commerce, and there are civil penalties and fines that occur under that statute. Again, that's for the government only. And as we'll talk about, the Defend Trade Secrets Act actually now provides for a private right of action for trade secret misappropriation. We look at the penalties under the Economic Espionage Act for an individual, not more than 15 years of imprisonment. For an organization, a company, not greater than a fine or penalty, whatever you want to call it, $10 million or three times the value of the information that was stolen. And the fines can include the expenses to have created the information and the cost that the folks that stole it avoided by stealing the information rather than coming up with it on their own. I think at this point, we'll turn this over to Kate Pirelli, who will go through the theft of trade secrets statutes.
Happy to do that, Mike. Good morning and good afternoon to everybody. Under the Theft of Trade Secrets Act, which is at 18 U.S.C. 1832, there are six elements which are laid out on the slide. The first three are similar or the same, actually, as those that were just mentioned in 1831. And just quickly, the defendant stole or without authorization from the owner, obtained or destroyed or conveyed information. Defendant knew it was information that was proprietary to the owner. Showed that the information was in fact a trade secret. The defendant intended to convert the trade secret to economic benefit of anyone other than the owner. The defendant also had to know or intend that the owner of the trade secret would be injured, and the trade secret was related to or was included in a product that was produced or placed in interstate or foreign commerce. You can see on the last three bullets, there's much less focus on the government as a plaintiff as there was under the statute that Mike was just talking about. The penalties on the next slide, for an individual, not more than 10 years of imprisonment. And for organizations, not more than the greater of $5 million or three times the value of what the trade secret was worth to the organization. And then the fines can include expenses for research and design and other costs of reproducing the trade secret that the organization avoided by stealing the trade secret. On to the next slide, Mike mentioned this at the beginning of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is another tool in the arsenal against trade secret theft and misappropriation, not only by the government, but also was amended to include civil action. This was primarily a criminal law that was aimed at malicious interferences with computer systems and to address federal computer offenses. And it was amended, I think, in 1994 to allow civil actions and aggressive civil litigants and those on the phone using that on behalf of their clients as a tool to pursue trade secret misappropriation. Just some of the highlights of what the law was intended to outlaw, which you see on the slide here, is corporate trespassing on a government computer, otherwise known as hacking. Corporate trespassing resulting in exposure to a government, credit organization, financial or computer housed information, also a hacking type of offense. Three, damaging government bank computers or computers used in interstate and foreign commerce, more commonly seen in computer virus or attempting to harm computer systems with viruses or malware. Next slide. Also intended to outlaw committing fraud against a government unit using computer, bank computers, computers used in interstate commerce. The fraud, an integral part of the fraud, has to be the unauthorized access to those computers, protected computers. Also, threatening damage to such systems, such computers, not actually committing the damage, but threatening it. Additionally, outlawed trafficking in passwords, obtaining passwords and then trafficking those or selling those for financial gain to harm government computers or computers impacting interstate or foreign commerce. And then last, accessing computer to commit espionage. And this last piece is primarily the piece that civil litigants have used as a tool to go after those who misappropriate trade secrets. As Mike mentioned at the beginning of the webinar, there are some phrases in this particular statute, elements that need to be satisfied, which include if any person who knowingly accesses a computer system without authorization or has exceeded that authorized access. Those three phrases, knowingly access, without authorization, or exceeding authorized access, are phrases that can be elusive in the cases and trying to prove them, and have been have resulted in many differing interpretations in the cases across the circuits in the country, with a split in the circuits as to what they might mean. Hacking, hacking is much easier to establish under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. The outside interloper, if you will, that's committing the types of violations that are laid out in this act. It's the inside hacking or inside intruder where it becomes much more difficult for the courts to agree on what actually constitutes knowing access without authorization, and particularly when the interloper exceeds the access. And that's been the debate in a lot of the cases across the country in determining what that means. And it ranges anywhere from an employee whose access and authorization has been revoked. Is that a violation? Ninth Circuit recently said so in U.S. versus NoCell case, the NoCell 2 case, which you may all be familiar with, where someone used a password of a former colleague, former employee, current employee of an organization, and that employee had shared the password with the former employee who used it to access the system, and that was viewed, at least in my view, quite easily viewed as exceeding authorization. So there are narrow interpretations of the language, and there are broader ones, as I said, ranging from the outsider hacking to the insider hacker. This particular statute has been used as a way to get into the federal court when there's an absence of diversity between the parties, and it's that's really at least in my view how it started being used and has led to, as I said, some very varying decisions across the country. It's going to be interesting to see how the passage of the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which I'll talk about in just a moment, impacts the usage of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act as a civil litigation tool. That will be, time will tell, but even I think Mike and I were talking about this yesterday. We haven't seen it as frequently in the cases we've seen this year since the passage of the Defend Trade Secrets Act. Just onto the penalty on the next slide, please. The criminal penalties range from imprisonment not exceeding a year to life, imprisonment when death results from intentional computer damage, so pretty serious penalties, as you can see. A fine, imprisonment for not more than 10 years or both if the offense does not occur after a conviction for another offense in that section, and then also fine or imprisonment for not more than 20 years or both if the offense occurs after a conviction for another offense in that section. On the civil side, the civil penalties or civil damage or loss that need to be proved under the statute, so, you can recover compensatory damages, injunctive relief, lost profits and revenues caused by the defendant's use of the data that was improperly obtained. There's lots of, it's a $5,000 minimum damage element to make a claim under this particular statute as a civil litigant. There's all kinds of case law out there on what constitutes that $5,000 in damages. Very frequently, the forensic computer review of what damage or what information has been taken can be, depending upon what your state you're in or circuit you're in, can constitute the minimum damages necessary to make a claim for damages under that particular provision. So time will tell. As I said, we can go to the next slide, how this will be impacted by the Defend Trade Secrets Act that was passed earlier this year. The Defend Trade Secrets Act was what it does is federalizes trade secret law. It used to be that relief was only available under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. As Mike mentioned, that particular act has been passed in 48 states with the exception of Massachusetts and New York. The other avenue was under common law claims for misappropriation or unfair comp. This particular act now piggybacks on the Economic Espionage Act, as Mike talked about, by creating a private right of action and setting forth uniform standards for trade secret misappropriation. It also creates new remedies, provides a way to obtain injunctive relief and monetary damages in federal court for companies facing trade secret disclosure. It used to be just the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, as I mentioned, that was the federal hook to get yourself into federal court without diversity jurisdiction. Another purpose is, impact of it is it harmonizes the difference in the trade secret laws across the various states that have adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, which is very helpful, and it provides for a uniform approach to discovery. I can go on to the next slide. Some of the key points under the Act, as I mentioned, there's new remedies. One of the most extraordinary of the remedies that's available under this Act is a new ex parte seizure provision that helps prevent the dissemination of trade secrets. It provides for a process whereby you can apply for an order without notice to the other side to go in and retrieve the trade secrets that were misappropriated. It's a rather extraordinary remedy, as I said. It's only available if other remedies are insufficient, for instance, a preliminary injunction or some other damages approach to the misappropriation. There's some very important limitations on it. It has to be certain that this will minimize, the seizure will be done in such a way to minimize the interruption of business for the third party that you're seeking to retrieve the misappropriated trade secret from, and it will proceed on a very tight time schedule with a hearing date very quickly after the seizure, if the seizure is permitted. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as now as an additional tool. It also provides new protections against disclosing trade secrets during litigation. They can't be disclosed unless they're filed under seal with court. And it also provides specific protections, the Act, for employees disclosing trade secrets in two instances. And this has been referred to, will be referred to as the immunity provisions under the Act. And employers have an affirmative obligation to notify their employees and agreements and contracts entered into with employees, as well as consultants and independent contractors, any of those agreements after May 11th of 2016, which was the effective date of the Act, have to notify of the following two situations that provide immunity. One is protection from civil or criminal liability if the trade secret is disclosed in confidence to a government official or their attorney, and the disclosure is made for purposes of reporting a violation of the law, also known as a whistleblower protection. The second is an individual who files a lawsuit for retaliation by an employer for reporting a suspected violation of the law may disclose the trade secret to an attorney to use in court. Has to be done under seal. But those two protections have to be disclosed in agreements going forward. So for those of you who are moving towards updating your non-disclosure agreements, your restrictive covenants and confidentiality agreements and policies, these are the types of provisions that will have to be included in them to get to obtain the protections of the Trade Secrets Act. A couple of other quick things just to mention on it. The Act is not retroactive, so it applies, as I mentioned, agreements after May 11th, 2016, and it enhances RICO claims, as Mike mentioned, and Mike will talk about in just a few minutes. So it provides some additional protections under the RICO statute. Next slide, please. In terms of criminal penalties, what it has increased certain of the criminal penalties provided for under the Economic Espionage Act. It used to be that for an organization, you could obtain up to $5 million for a violation or be charged with $5 million for a violation. Now it's the greater of $5 million or three times the value of the trade secret to the organization, which could, of course, be much greater than $5 million. It provides a higher level of recovery. Then finally, just a couple of quick points. You know, again, we're going to see how this plays out in civil litigation. I don't think it's necessarily a panacea for all of our strategies in those cases. These cases will require, because they're in federal court, a unanimous jury verdict on the whether the trade secret was misappropriated. In many instances, state court may still be a more favorable venue for either. For purposes of summary judgment, maybe a more fertile ground for summary judgment. There's much tighter timeframes in the federal courts in terms of moving a case along, as well as much more aggressive e-discovery obligations in the federal court. So those are all things that will have to be taken into account to determine whether that tool is an effective tool to go after a trade secret misappropriator. I'm going to turn it over to Andrew Boutros to take you through making your case attractive to the feds.
Thanks very much, Kate. And I think I also come bearing additional information, probably one of the highlights, which is the CLE number. And so we have the CLE number now for those who are online. It is SS, which is Sam SS. 2039. So once again, SS 2039, and that is the CLE number. And so as Mike and Kate sort of went through, there are a lot of statutes and a lot of provisions that are available to civil litigants to litigate in federal or state court about trade secret violations and misappropriations. But then the question is, when is it appropriate, or when do clients either want to proactively try to get the federal government, usually the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's offices, involved? And what do you do if you're on the receiving end as a client of a grand jury subpoena or of a knock and talk by federal agents dealing with a trade secret theft or a misappropriation? Interestingly enough, one of the first cases that I confronted when I joined CIFARTH from the U.S. Attorney's Office was, in fact, a case with Kate Pirelli, who just went through some of the various statutes, where one of our clients indeed had such a scenario and the issue came up on a proactive basis as opposed to on a defensive basis, so more offensively than reactively. And really there are a lot of differences between and considerations between the criminal side and the civil side, and I think it's we'll go through many of them, and it's certainly critical to think through the implications of getting the government involved or what to do once the government indicates that it does want to get involved. Mike started off the presentation talking about trade secrets and talking about sort of the value of trade secrets. And, you know, the FBI has set out some points for private parties to think about when they want to come forward and talk about the economic value of the potential trade secret theft. Things such as the competitive advantage for the owner in using the trade secret, the cost for an outsider to duplicate the trade secret, the lost advantages to the trade secret owner resulting from disclosure to competitors. Think of things such as, you know, special formulas or the secret sauce or a recipe that is makes a particular brand famous. What does that recipe or that secret sauce, what is it worth? And sometimes it's extremely difficult to put a price tag on it, as Kate said, often requiring experts in economists to come in and try to value that trade secret. Also, the statements of the defendant can be very powerful as well. The defendant's admission, statement of a party opponent, of what he or she or it thinks the value of that trade secret is or the theft is can also be very substantial. So there is a trade secret. Let's assume there is a trade secret theft. Let's assume that the client or the aggrieved party wants to get potentially wants to get the federal government involved. How would the client go about to do so? And here are some things that as a prosecutor that we look for when we're deciding whether or not to take what otherwise might be a civil litigation or a dispute between the parties and really sort of convert it into a criminal case where someone can go to prison. It's often, you know, it's sort of like the discussion of when does a contract dispute, a breach between the parties, when does it become a, you know, wire fraud or a mail fraud or a bank fraud violation as opposed to merely a private contractual dispute between two parties? And in the case of fraud, often the difference is affirmative lies and misrepresentations or omissions and material omissions. And in the case of trade secret theft, it's really looking for aggravating facts, facts that make that would make the federal government really get interested. And oftentimes those facts are things such as the dollar amount, big ticket items, the value of the trade secret, how much is it worth, you know, frankly, the identity of the parties, whether or not the parties are well known. Is this a theft of a very well-known brand that will make a splash and certainly send some general deterrence message as well? And from the government's perspective, it could also be, handing the government a lot of this information on a silver platter, frankly. So having already conducted the investigation, having the fruits of those efforts being able to be presented to the government so that the government is being given a case that is already well on its way as opposed to having to start from scratch. And we'll actually talk about some issues relating to that very last point. As you can see, you know, when the government wants to make sure, that it can meet the elements and that it can ultimately prove, not just by preponderance of the evidence, but by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that it can satisfy those elements and that these are things that a jury will appreciate and that a jury will understand and that a jury won't roll its eyes at. And so it's looking for things such as, you know, did the trade secret holder, were they affirmatively taking steps, as Mike said at the very beginning, to keep their secret secret? Or were they reckless or negligent or lazy or not very diligent in protecting what they today claim are the crown jewels? And so right here we have a laundry list of things, such as everything from physical precautions, fencing and visitor controls and signs and in-and-out procedures and badges and the like. and things that are more sort of policy-driven, security policies, usernames and passwords, how often are they changed, you know, computer servers, are they available to everyone, the computer logs, you know, was there any background investigations or exit interviews that were required as part of the company's efforts in protecting the trade secrets. Prosecutors are looking for, they're looking for the worst cases oftentimes, the most egregious cases. Is this an example where someone stole the trade secret either in a very sophisticated way? Did they involve lots of other people so that you really have sort of a concerted conspiracy among many different actors to do this, and so that this wasn't being done in isolation, but this was something that was deliberate and sought out? Was this reactive, meaning did someone sort of, you know, have a bad day at the office and react by saying, I'm going to take this with me? Again, certainly wrong and potentially criminal. Or was this something that was deliberate and calculated and planned and done in a very sophisticated and covert fashion so that it wouldn't be detected? The things that are more difficult to detect are often the things that need to be punished in the harshest of fashions, because they often go undetected and unpunished. And again, how critical is this particular trade secret, and what is the damage that's at issue? So as you could see from this laundry list, the prosecutors who are looking at these cases, they have a panoply of other cases that are on their plates, everything from violent crimes in some of the big cities to major, you know, narcotics trafficking and bank fraud issues and child pornography and human trafficking. There are so many different issues that a prosecutor has to potentially investigate and prosecute. So then the question becomes, why this case? Why should they really look at a theft of trade secret, particularly when there may be a civil remedy that's available? On this, you know, continuing with this sort of theme, I think things that will certainly get the prosecutor's attention or the U.S. Attorney's Office attention is whether the trade secret potentially has civilian or military use. Which one is it? Is it something that can, if it's stolen, that can be put on a missile and sent and exported overseas to countries that are hostile to the United States? Countries that, you know, have often been referred to as, say, the axis of evil, or countries that are unfriendly to the United States and to its interests. Those types of violations or those types of fact patterns are naturally going to gain the government's attention much more so than ones that perhaps don't have those fact patterns. Also, are there any foreign countries that are involved? Is this state-sponsored? Is this a situation where a government has allowed for hackers in it from its own country to come in and hack into the computer systems of either the government or private industry, research development, et cetera, or are these purely private actors? Also, you know, what is the reality of the government being able to apprehend and extradite and bring back to the United States potentially foreign actors who might have engaged in the trade secret theft overseas? And that would really require an understanding of whether or not there are extradition treaties with that particular country, whether there are mutual legal assistance treaties between the United States and that particular foreign country, whether or not the foreign country in question allows for its citizens to be extradited. Sometimes a country will allow for foreign nationals to be extradited, but not their own citizens, for various reasons, including provisions even in their own constitutions that prohibit it. So again, prosecutor doesn't want to spend countless time and effort investigating and prosecuting a case only at the end of the day to never have a body or a person that they can ultimately have face trial. Additional things that I think are important to keep in mind as you're considering whether or not to come forward, or again, if you happen to be on the receiving end of an enforcement action or of an inquiry from the government. But if you're sort of on the should we engage the government side of things, things such as what's the strength of the evidence and what's the difficulty or the ease in proving the conduct at issue. So is this a case that the jury can easily understand? Is this a slam dunk where there's no question that the putative defendant, in fact, stole the trade secret? Do you have a transcript from a deposition where the defendant admitted to stealing the trade secret, and so that there is, you know, essentially a party admission of the misconduct? Or is this in a circumstantial case where lots of different circumstantial pieces, a lot of different things that maybe give rise to smoke, but will it really sort of show fire and enable the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the violation? Are key witnesses cooperating? Have key witnesses gone out and hired their own attorneys, and are they invoking the Fifth Amendment? Are they not really sort of available witnesses absent a grant of immunity? Where did the crime take place? Not all U.S. attorneys' offices view these types of offenses perhaps in the same way. And so how sophisticated is the U.S. attorney's office? What track record does the U.S. attorney's office have to bring in these types of cases? And, you know, there's also issues of venue. Where does venue lie? And to a certain extent, are there certain jurisdictions where perhaps it may not be the most obvious choice for trade secrets prosecution, but perhaps you have a very favorable office there, and that office would, in fact, want to bring it if as long as it has venue. For example, you know, in the sort of prosecutorial world, you know, New York, oftentimes the Southern District of New York or Brooklyn, they will find venue and find jurisdiction, even if it may not be obvious, whether it's something as simple as a wire crossing through their banking system or going through their banking system, or a trade show or something else that might occur in their jurisdiction. We talked about this briefly previously, but, you know, sort of has the internal investigation already been completed? Has the civil case already been, is it far along in the process that things can just be given to the government, as opposed to does the government have to start from scratch and allocate and commit its own resources to conducting the investigation? You know, oftentimes, and this is something that's really debated pretty extensively internally within the Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney's Office, but the civil remedy. Is this a case that really requires the intervention of the government? Will the defendants be sufficiently punished through civil lawsuits and through the civil process? Why should the government come in and extract an additional punishment? And that's, again, where the aggravating facts and the more sort of aggravation that you can show, by analogy, it takes that breach of contract case and it turns it into a wire fraud or a mail fraud type of claim. Has the defendant, the putative defendant, returned the trade secret? Did he, even though he or she may have taken it, have they used it? Have they incorporated it into their new employer's systems? Have they profited from it? Or did they take it and keep it on a thumb drive and have it in a box in their home, and it still hasn't resulted in confirmed damages? Again, not to say that it's ever right for someone to take the trade secret, but what kind of damage has the theft caused? Is it limited or is it pretty expansive? And I think Mike and Kate and all of us will certainly be able to sort of jump in here with these next two slides, but in terms of working with law enforcement, it's important to know that there are lots of differences when you are working with law enforcement, and that it's important to appreciate that going in and reporting a case to the FBI or to the U.S. Attorney's Office, that there is a specific or a particular process that's involved, and that it's not just simply a sort of another civil matter, and that the things that the prosecutors want to hear, that the U.S. Attorney's Office wants to hear, could very well be different than what might really be a priority for the client or for the aggrieved party. They may be looking at this in a different way. So you want to be sure to pitch the right office. Again, you want to make sure that you're not just viewing this as another example of a civil matter and appreciating the differences between the civil and the criminal law and the implications of each. You want to really show yourself not just as being a victim. I mean, certainly for an aggrieved party, they are a victim, and they will be treated as a victim. but you almost want to make yourself a partner. You want to come in and say, this is what's happened. Here's what we've done. Here's what we found out. Here's where our investigation has hit a stumbling block because we don't have the grand jury subpoena power. We don't have search warrant powers. There are certain things that we can't do that the government can do, but we want to work with you to get this information, and here's why you, the government, should care and why you should make this a priority in terms of your cases.
And also, we can be very practical for a moment, which is this. It's difficult to simply call up the FBI or call up the U.S. Attorney's Office and say, hey, can I speak to someone? I want to bring to your attention a trade secrets case. Quite frankly, the interaction with those offices is difficult to get simply over a phone call or the public calling in. And I'm not going to comment if that's fortunate or unfortunate, but that's just the reality. So when the situation arises where you want to interact with law enforcement because of a serious trade secrets claim, quite frankly, the attorneys that you hire to help you is important because you need attorneys that have connections to those offices, whether they're former prosecutors like Andrew or myself, whether there's someone like Kate who has a long history of handling these types of matters and working with federal attorneys and federal law enforcement. Those things matter when you want to get the federal government involved. A point in case, we had a situation where a client, a well-known drug manufacturer, had an employee that left, took with that employee a disk or a thumb drive, and on that thumb drive was all the information with regard to the formulas and production yields and all the laboratory information for producing certain drugs that were in the market already, as well as drugs that would be put into the marketplace that were up for FDA approval but not released to the public. Well, that's a serious situation, and the value of that was over a billion dollars. The parties involved were well-known names. So what we did is through contacts that we had, we got the Justice Department involved, the FBI, U.S. Attorney involved in the jurisdiction, the relevant jurisdiction. We then teamed with them, and literally they executed search warrants at residences to get the information back and locate the offender at the same time that we went to federal court on the civil side of things and obtained injunctions against the individual and the new employer to limit their activities with regard to our information and the job that they held. So there's a situation where the government got involved, did its thing, we were doing our thing on the civil side, and then ultimately grand jury was convened to deal with the situation on the criminal side of things. And that's a prime, almost a case study in how you're able to potentially work with law enforcement. But you know, as we mentioned earlier, there's positives and there's negatives to having the federal government involved because you put a microscope or you have someone looking under the hood of your car at the same time you're working on this situation. And some clients don't necessarily want that type of interaction.
Go ahead. I wanted to add one point on the negative side. And I see there's a question just on are there cautionary tales? And this is on the next slide. I think we'd come to it. But in the interest of time, I figured I'd point it out now is that, once the government is involved, you can have the risk of losing control of your civil case. So if you are nearing a settlement or you are in a position where you've been able to limit discovery, as Mike said, you're not opening up the hood completely. Those limitations, that those settlement efforts may be thrown for a loop if the U.S. Attorney's Office gets involved or the FBI gets involved. So sometimes you have no control over whether the government's involved if you're on the receiving end, obviously. But if you are trying to prompt the government's involvement, those are things that are very important to think about, as well as PR and publicity and all the types of things that you may not want out in your particular industry. So just a cautionary tale. And just one other piece on this, too, in terms of working with law enforcement to get their attention, if you do want to involve them, I think it depends on where you are, which U.S. Attorney's Office you're dealing with, which FBI office, but there's certainly much more interest these days in cases that involve foreign nationals than there is in just a theft of proprietary information by an employee. or a trade secret. So you're going to have to be prepared to make the case to the prosecutors or the FBI to get interested. And as Andrew, I think, mentioned at the beginning of his comments, you've got to build your own case to get their attention. But that's all I had. I'll turn it back over to you guys.
Yeah, and sort of piggybacking off of what Mike and Kate said, you know, again, one of the first cases I got involved in here at the firm was with Kate and involving a theft of trade secret issue. And here are some of the issues that just sort of immediately came up as we began working through it. Kate talked about what impact does it have on the civil settlement, but also, or the civil process, but also the reality that, you know, once a grand jury is convened and once subpoenas are issued and the like, there's a very real possibility that the party accused of the theft will ask for the court to stay the civil proceedings in light of the criminal case. It's very likely that they will invoke their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent with whatever adverse consequences that may arise from it, because they can't sit in for a deposition. So as Kate sort of mentioned, not only could there be a very real impact on a civil settlement, but the involvement of law enforcement early on in an investigation could in fact bring the civil litigation to a complete halt should a judge stay the proceedings. Also, sorry, Kate, were you going to say something?
No, go ahead.
Oh, and one of the other things sort of things to think about is, you know, what impact does a protective order, for example, have on your ability to disclose information to law enforcement? Oftentimes, the party who wants to go to law enforcement early on or wants to go to law enforcement at all wants to do so in a very quiet fashion and may not want the other side or the opposing side to be aware that they are bringing in the feds and that they're bringing in those resources or those the U.S. Attorney's Office. Well, is it an option to do so if you're already subject to a protective order and the parties are not allowed to provide any information to anyone, absent providing notice to all parties involved in the protective order? Interestingly enough, it's an issue that Kate and I and Mike have confronted, and we've had to research this issue, and the circuits are split on whether or not you would need to move in federal court and obtain an order from a court to essentially get permission to even comply with a subpoena from law enforcement and to notify the parties of receipt of a subpoena, or whether a grand jury subpoena is considered to vitiate the protective order provisions. And so, as you can see, there are many different aspects, some of which are not obvious and some of which in many ways may not even be intuitive, that sort of come up during this process. And so that's why, as Mike mentioned and Kate as well, it's definitely critical to sort of have to collaborate with folks who really sort of understand these issues and can think ahead five steps because there may be things that come up down the road that may not be obvious now. I'll skip over move forward to Mike to the next slides, but just on this slide here, as you can see, again, things to whet the government's appetite, you know, and you always have to also keep in mind what is ultimately your goal here. You, as the aggrieved party, what do you really want? Do you want restitution? Do you want to send a message? Do you want to see the perpetrator in prison? What is it that you really want, and why do you want to get the government involved? And as Kate said and Mike, are you better off doing it on your own through the civil system? And if you do want to bring in the feds, you should have you should know the reason why you want to do so.
So a few other considerations. We're getting towards the end of the time here, so we want to just run through a few more pieces of information for you. This is a problem. It's a growing problem. In fact, if you look at the value of trade secrets, according to certain studies, it's $5 trillion worth of trade secrets are owned by U.S. companies. And when trade secret losses occur, they can be huge. According to PwC, 1 to 3% of U.S. GDP is lost because of trade secret thefts. Other things that you need to be aware of is typically the misappropriation of trade secrets, it's not just a situation where some foreign government is hacking in or a competitor is hacking in. It's typically a situation where someone you know, someone at the company is copying files, is sending things out through email, is plugging in the thumb drive, taking their computer home, they're copying their entire computer, they're taking documents with them. You know, in the old days, someone would pull their van or car up to the loading dock, they'd open the trunk, and they'd take 10 boxes of stuff, and they would throw it into the back of their trunk and drive away. Now, with email and electronic storage, you can put all this information in something that will literally be smaller than your thumb and take it with you. And so typically, those are the cases that we see a lot, where an employee or former employee or maybe someone's business partner steals information. Trade secret theft is not something that's reported a lot. It's not reported a lot because you typically may not see it until all of a sudden your sales are going down or your products out there in the marketplace is being copied, or a secret process that you use to make a product is now suddenly being used by someone else to produce a competitive device. Maybe information was stolen regarding margins, pricing, so someone is all of a sudden undercutting your pricing. There's all kinds of different ways that these things occur, and it may not be known right away, and these things have great effects both on stock prices, public relations, things that motivate people not to report this. For example, it's because you accuse someone and, someone thinks, you're accusing a competitor and people know people there, or you're accusing a foreign country and people get offended by that. Those sorts of things which affect reputation and branding, those are difficult to measure with regard to monetary terms. RICO, we mentioned earlier, for a while was the soup du jour. Everyone wanted to use civil RICO. It was sexy. It was hot. It had all kinds of penalties and fees and exemplary damages. It was a wonderful statute. People tried to use that a lot back in the day. And then these civil remedies became disfavored because judges in the federal courts didn't like these cases. They were complicated. They have a lot of legal elements to them. And people were bringing these cases at the drop of a hat. And so there was a trend of sorts that these matters would be dismissed, and that the judges would not like to see these cases in their courtroom. But the Defend Trade Secrets Act has actually been added as a predicate act to the RICO statutes, because under the statutes, you have to have what's called a predicate act, which is certain types of crimes that are recognized by federal government in statutes. And if you have those crimes, and there's a whole bunch of other elements, you can go forward to civil RICO claim. When you look at civil RICO, there are a lot of considerations and a lot of elements, and here are just a few. Is income being invested? Is there a pattern of racketeering activity? Is a racketeering activity being used to acquire or maintain control of an enterprise? Is the enterprise's affairs being handled through a pattern of racketeering? Is there conspiring or conspiracy to engage in the acts? Are acts done in furtherance? Are there acts done in furtherance of the crimes? As you mentioned, the courts didn't like these things. Now, because it is a predicate act, that means that it is possible that we're going to see a resurgence in the civil RICO statutes being used as a tool to bring claims when people's trade secrets are misappropriated, which means that not only can folks bring these claims, but also that means that when these claims are brought, you have to defend against them. And so it's important to make sure that you are aware of these situations and deal with them appropriately. I think, Kate, do you want to run through some of these quickly?
Sure. I'll do this quickly. I know we're coming up towards the end here. But perhaps we should have even started with these slides as I look through them today. But the best practices, I suppose, so you don't have to invoke any of these tools that we've been talking about, is to protect your own home, as they say, and put some tools in place before the misappropriation occurs, hopefully to avoid it even happening. Here are some examples. We've mentioned throughout agreements with employees which define what proprietary information is and what they can and can't do with it, non-disclosure agreements, invention assignment agreements that detail what happens with an invention when an employee leaves if they've worked on it. And to make sure those are updated, as we mentioned, very important as you move forward to make sure they're updated to comply with the Defend Trade Secrets Act if you want to get protections under that act by including the notice and immunity provisions I mentioned. Important to always take a look at your agreements, update them, make sure they've been signed. Many times if you've got a large workforce, the agreements go out and people are too busy to make sure that they've come back signed. Very, very important to audit your agreements and make sure they're up to date as well as signed. Employee policies and handbooks, make sure they also are tailored, well-tailored, updated. There's some notification or signatory to those as well, whether it's online or hard copies. Training. One of the things courts will look at is what are you as the holder of the trade secret doing to train your employees on how to handle that information, how to keep it confidential, keep it a trade secret, and not just once every 10 years, but on an ongoing basis to make sure people are aware that they're handling very sensitive information and the steps they need to take to protect it. Same thing with third parties. Don't only look at your employees. Think about clients that you're providing information to, vendors, contractors, suppliers. If you're in the middle of an M&A deal, obviously put agreements in place to make sure that the companies you're talking with about potential acquisitions or mergers or whatever it may be, that the information that you're sharing is going to be provided for by an agreement. Next slide. And then in terms of your systems, this should be obvious at this point in our lives with all the electronic access that we all have. Secure networks, secure facility, passwords protection for your hardware and software. Need to know distribution of materials. Don't let your entire workforce on your system to look at highly sensitive information. If you do, a court or prosecutor is not going to be sympathetic to someone walking away with your materials. Lock and key, so to speak, not just your computer systems, but also your facilities. If you've got R&D function in your particular headquarters or wherever workplace, make sure that not everybody can come and go as they please. Another, it's not on the slide, but exit interviews. Make sure that you're having exit interviews with your employees, reminding them of their obligations, of the agreements that they signed, and the policies that are in place that they need to be mindful as they leave your workforce. Mike mentioned this earlier, just notices on documents or even on computer screens if things are being transferred electronically, that it's confidential, that it's only for internal use. Put some authorization processes in place that people can't provide information to third parties without a certain approval being authorized. And then finally, the protocol for broker recruiting, very familiar, obviously, those in the financial services industry. Make sure you're following that protocol as you recruit and bring people on. If you don't, you're not going to get much sympathy from the court system or from U.S. Attorney's Office. And those are just a few of the things, just in terms of eternal housekeeping, but critically important if you think you're going to get any protection from either civil or criminal remedies, that you take care of your own house and protect it. I'll turn it back over to Mike to wrap us up.
So we want to thank you for participating in the webinar today. Feel free to contact us if you need assistance, you have questions, thoughts. You'll see our contact information. You can certainly look at the SIFAR Shaw website, and you can find Kate Pirelli or Andrew Boutros or myself listed there as attorneys working in the office. Here's our contact information. If you want to jot anything down for a moment. And then
we'll be sure to answer questions too, Mike. I just let them know we've got a number of them we can't get to.
Oh, right. We'll answer your questions. We'll get back to folks after the completion of the webinar. And also, if you want to stay current on a lot of these issues, we have a bunch of resources you can go to. Go to our blog at tradesecretslaw.com. It's up to date. It's quite fashionable. It has everything, the latest going on. So go to the website, and you can go through and search past articles, current articles. You can see practitioners in the area. Also, you can request our 50-state desktop reference on non-compete and trade secret issues, which is up there. You see a little cover there. And also, we have a specific new brochure on the Defend Trade Secrets Act, which gives you a lot more detail about the act, and that you can request also from us or through the website. So a bunch of resources for you. Again, we thank you. We will answer your questions that folks have presented to us. We tried to answer some of the questions during the presentation by just adding some thoughts. So we hopefully we answered some of the questions, but we'll go through and make sure that we get a hold of everyone that had further questions. And again, thank you for participating. Thank you for your questions. And we hope if you have anything further, you'll let us know. And have a wonderful day.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending. You may now disconnect.